Let's talk. Talk. John Brown. Basra and Back, the memoir of an unlikely infantryman in the Iraq War, is a fascinating new book from Matt Akohara. You will remember him from before because he was on as the nuclear copper. I'm delighted to say that Matt has decided to come back on the show. Good morning to you, my friend.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. I mean, I thought you would have got off lightly last time, but there you go. Now, I find this really, really interesting because this is looking at, because we've had, you know, normally we get memoirs of people who are in, I don't know, SAS, specialist units, etc. You know, all that sort of the heat, the dust, you know, fighting against the counterinsurgency measures and the whole thing like that. This is a tale of the unsung, if you like, warriors. Explain to me a little bit about what you were doing before you were kind of called up, as it were, Matt.
Okay, before I was called up, Bob, for the sake of everyone else listening, I was not a regular soldier, I was a reserve soldier.
Yeah.
So at the same time as training with the military, and I was not very well trained, I was a bank clerk. So you think Dad's Army, do you remember that show, Dad's Army?
Of course, yeah.
Private Pike. Okay, so I was just this guy who sat on the bank desk, handing cash transactions, and then I was a soldier at weekends.
So this is it used to be called territorials, didn't it? That was the thing, the TA.
Yeah, that's what I was, the territorial armies, before it changed into the Army Reserve, but essentially it's the same thing.
So when you signed up for, when you got involved with the Army Reserves, was it just a sort of, because you kind of liked the idea of you know, putting something back and keeping fit and having, you know, was that the reason? And did you actually think that you were going to be called up at any point?
Well, I didn't think I was going to be, so there's two questions. I didn't think I was going to get called up. I'd spoken to some of the other reserves and only one of them had been called up, and that was for Bosnia a long time ago. And she was a clerk, so she was very good at administration. They wanted some help. So, well, you're never going home unless there's a Third World War. But I wanted to join the army. That's why I was in the TA. But I found, upon looking at the army, that the money wasn't so good. You get paid more as a bank clerk. So I did that job, and then I fulfilled my military ambitions on the weekends.
And so there you are, in the bank, you know, doing your bits and pieces. And obviously, war breaks out in Iraq. Do you at any point think this might involve me? Do you have any sort of warning or, what were your thoughts when it all kicked off in Iraq then?
When it kicked off, it's business as normal. I mean, Afghanistan had been going on and I've been called up for that. And then a few years before, like I said, Bosnia, we had one person from the company, they were called up. And then Iraq, well, I thought nothing of it. When the call up happened, I can't say the word on the radio, I guess.
Yes.
But I was a little bit shocked.
But I mean, they're not throwing you into front line. This is a different one. What's the role then? And also, when you assemble is it your unit? I mean, do you have a platoon? Is it a company? Explain a little bit about the operational situation.
Well, because I was trained as infantry, it was the front line. So we were deployed right into the city for city patrols around Basra City. And what they decided to do, which they hadn't done since the Suez crisis, was actually form a company of reservists. So the major, the captain, who's the second in command, all the platoon commanders were all reserve. Everyone in the company was reserve. It's not happened for like 50 years. It happens quite a lot now. It was the first time it happened. And what they did, they brought us all to Nottingham, gave us a load of injections, a load of equipment, did a few months training, stuck us on a plane and out into the air, into the Arabian Peninsula.
Presumably, if you've gone on patrol in Nottingham, Basra must have been a piece of what's it then, presumably, yeah?
Well, yeah, exactly.
What's the reaction then of if you like, the regular? I mean, because this has always interested me, the reaction between the regular army and the reservist. I mean, do they think, oh, go, here come the weekend, boys and girls?
there is a bit of that. What they say now is that it's all one army.
Yeah.
They say it's all one army. Everyone's trained to the same standard. I guess I get where the regulars are coming from, because a reservist isn't doing it day in, day out, like a regular soldier is. But when we were there, I was very, very new to the army. I was 19 years old. In total, when my call-up papers came, I had about 30 days of experience under my belt.
Right.
And that's rounding up and being generous in calling it a weekend, a whole day, an evening, a whole day's training. I was really rounding up. I was the youngest in the company and probably the least experienced as well.
So what were your first impressions then when you was whisked from Nottingham through to Iraq?
Well, we had a period of build-up training to begin with. We went to Nottingham for a weekend and we did all our build-up training in the southwest of the United Kingdom on Dartmoor. So we're training for the desert in the snow. It makes no sense. Okay, it's January in Dartmoor, we're training. Yeah. We completed that and in April, we had a couple of weeks off in April, out to Iraq. And the first thing that hit me, and it comes as no surprise, the tailgate of the Hercules comes down. This heat comes in. It's just like getting someone holding a hairdryer in your face. It's that hot. It's so hot you could taste it.
Yeah.
And that's my first impression. A few steps from the aircraft into the terminal building, because we were using Basra Airport, and I was sweating. It was hot.
Yeah.
Really hot.
And, I mean, you presumably get, whisked to a compound, a barracks, and then is it a very quick turnaround? I mean, there we are with 30 days of training, and suddenly you're in this zone, which is obviously making the front pages around the world. And Do you think, hang on a second, I was doing this as something to do at the weekends, and I don't feel prepared? Or is the training that good that you think, okay, I can handle this?
Well, the first question, we had a week's worth of acclimatization to get used to the environment before being deployed into Basra City itself. But I had 30 days training, and then the call-up came, and then, a bit more training in the build-up. And by the time that was done, we were quite a well-formed company. We knew each other pretty well, and we had a decent amount of confidence, and possibly some of the officers had a bit more experience than us, and they were, helping us along in places. But when I arrived in theatre, I wasn't particularly nervous. I was more nervous at the start of the whole process. The call-up paper was like, oh my word. And then once I arrived in theatre, having gone through the build-up process, I was a bit more confident.
I suppose the thing is that before you get there, your mind is going through all the possible scenarios. Going into overdrive, what could happen? You're literally expecting sort of rocket propelled grenades, from the perimeter, as it were, as you land. But of course, when you actually get there, because your role is presumably the bulk of the fighting, there's still some skirmishing going on, has gone, and your role is basically keeping the peace.
That's right. Yeah, I use the line in the book as if the war's been won and now we've got to win the peace. So what they called it was a low intensity conflict, which is quite a misleading term to suggest that, that there's a reduced threat, which I guess it's not a...
a bullet singing past you is still a bullet singing past you, whether it's low,
Yeah, there's still IEDs, RPGs and bullets going all over the place, but they call it low-intensity conflict. And so what we were doing was augmenting what security services still existed in Iraq. There was the IZP, which is the National Police. There wasn't a military because it had been defeated. It wasn't being rebuilt. And there was the Coalition Provisional Authority as well, which was the interim government. We were waiting for that to be disassembled and for the Iraqi people to elect their own people and then start creating their society again.
So what was your first patrol like? Because really you're out there patrolling. So what was that? I mean, the sounds, the smells, every corner you must have been on, on tenterhooks, to put it mildly.
Well, yeah, our first patrol was on the 22nd of April. I remember that day because it was the first big day, really. And we arrived earlier in the day at our base, and our platoon was the first platoon to be sent out on patrol.
Yeah.
Just basically around the perimeter and into the city just to check for,
Quick problems. Question then, Matt. Then if you've got the first patrol of of reservists, who gets to go on points? I mean, who gets to be the first one on the corner?
A guy called Drewy. Drewy was first, I was second.
Oh, blimey.
So he ran out the gate because we got told once the gate opens, just sprint to the first bit of cover. So he ran, and then I ran his zigzag pattern, got into the city, and before we knew it, the whole platoon was in the city, and then we had to do... Well, what I remember particularly was that you talked about the training.
Yeah.
Crossing that barrier to get out into the city, it was not just like a threshold physically, it was a threshold in the mind as well. It's like training's over now. That's it. You're in. Anything that happens actually happens. So once we crossed into the city, it was like a switch was thrown in. I wasn't sort of hyper alert, but you were very, and I think a lot of us were just hyper focused and really concentrating on the patrol skills.
So when you're following Drewy out, out of the compound and across to quote unquote the first bit of cover, your heart rate must have gone stratospheric.
I imagine it may well have done. I don't remember as much about my heart rate. I remember it was hot. I remember it was raining. It was the only time it rained in the entire 6 months we were there.
Yeah.
There was a thunderstorm in the distance over the desert. And we head out into the city, and we walked away from the desert and further into Basra itself.
So you move from, I mean, presumably that first patrol goes out without anything too dramatic happening. I mean, you're not, like I said, you're not find yourself pinned down on the first corner. I mean, presumably you do the first patrol, you get back in, are you high-fiving each other? Or are you thinking, right, we're in here now? You know, we've actually been out in theatre, and this is what it is.
There was a bit of that, yeah, but we're also conscious of the fact that we had another patrol to do the very first thing in the morning. We got back in late at night,
yeah,
and so we had about 4 hours to rest, recuperate, and re-equip ourselves before heading back out on patrol. So it was quite a busy patrol program we had.
So explain to, because I mean, those who haven't you know, served in the military may not understand what you're trying to do with, because there are different types of patrol, you know, reconnaissance patrol, you know, et cetera, et cetera. What patrolling are you doing in Basra? What are the aims, or do they vary, Matt?
Yeah, well, what we have is a GDA patrol. It's a ground defense area patrol. And they said, because it was low intensity conflicts in the conventional military sense, like perhaps in the Ukraine or in the Falklands or the first Gulf War, one of those patrols would be to deny the enemy the opportunity to operate freely. In a low intensity conflict, the patrol is the same, but they say it's to prevent crime and to deter terrorism. So that's why we're heading out on patrol.
And interaction with, because I mean, you know, those of us who are warriors on Counter-Strike or something like that, you know, we're all familiar with the terrain, but you've got people wandering around, people trying to do their daily business. I mean, kids running up and going, yippee. Yeah. But you must have that going on. And again, you've got that sort of in the back of your mind, you've got that, you mentioned sort of, improvised explosive devices, etc., everywhere, and who knows what spotting and so. How do you, are you interacting with people around? I mean, what were you warned about there? Do you talk to the locals? Don't talk to the locals? I mean, what's the situation?
We did a kind of soft approach, so we did talk to locals. We'd have kids running up and people just conducting their normal business in the market or around town. So where possible, you speak to them. I mean, it's hard because they don't speak English. Some of them speak English.
Yeah.
Some of us learned a little bit of Arabic in order to be able to speak to them. And so we just tried to communicate as best we could. But it's completely opposite to Counter-Strike. You don't know who the bad guys are. You don't know where they are. We're in their territory. So they fight to their advantage. So when something did happen, the biggest combat indicator that something was about to happen was there was no one around.
Yeah.
You thought, that's strange. And then you're a bit more alert about what's going
so,
on.
So do you come under fire? Are there explosive devices? I mean, you know, are there situations where you think, okay, this is getting rather serious now?
Yeah. Our platoon came under fire quite a lot, which is what I put in the book. I've tried to put this opposite side to this hero's tale that you always get with Andy McNabb's in the Bravo 2-0, to try to make it a bit more human, a little bit more accessible, a little bit more realistic. I wouldn't say that, you know, Bravo 2 perhaps not realistic. Obviously, it's his lived experience, but I'm talking about a more general lived experience for the soldier, interspersed with the combat that we had to see.
Is it a surreal experience? Because those of us who've never actually had, as I said before, people trying to do us harm in a professional way, is it a surrealist experience when you and your group of friends, as you are now your mates, suddenly have, you know, come under fire and you think, hang on a second, you know, they're trying to, at the very least, incapacitate us?
Well, yeah, it was. I mean, I remember the first time coming under fire. I don't remember coming under fire. I remember being under fire. I don't remember how it started. That's gone. That's completely perceptual distortion. I don't know how or why we came under fire. I just remember being under fire and then reacting to that.
I mean, does the earth in Basra taste somewhat different when you've got your face in it going, please stop shooting at us?
Yeah, it does. It does taste pretty gritty. Yeah. So it's a... Yeah, I wished I was back on Dartmoor, but actually I was in Basra.
Yeah, you'd swap it for Oakhampton anytime. Anytime. What happens then? Training, as it's a cliche, but cliches are the cliches because they're true. Training kicks in, you just go into the, you know, you go through the drills and it's all sort of automatic.
Yeah, well, training did kick in. So I was in the infantry, as I said, but I was also trained as a medic.
Yeah.
To get that first aid to someone. The first time we came under fire, we were on patrol with three Iraqi coppers, and they all got hit. So the first thing that happened, I just got that medikit off my back and started treating the casualties as soon as I could, which was a little bit tactically not sensible because whilst I was treating, the pavement started disintegrating around me. And then I realized, well, I've got to move myself. So I dragged this guy back into some cover and then carry on. But yeah, the training does kick in. You focus on your task.
When you say the pavement started disintegrating around me, that's not just a testimony to the shoddy workmanship of Iraqi paving stones. That's the fact that people are trying to bleed and well shoot at you, Matt.
Yeah, it's a bit of both. Yeah, the concrete wasn't particularly solid, but mostly it was because we were being shot from a rooftop. So we had these people with AKs shooting down on us.
Oh, you just casually mentioned it. What's the, you know, you mentioned the sort of things disintegrating around you, but again, the actual situation there, I mean, you're in this big city, Basra is a big place, and they haven't, you know, there's problems with water, with lighting, with food, with sewage, I mean, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, there were no public services at all because we'd arrived so soon after the conflict had ended, after the Battle of Basra, all the public services were gone. What few public services did remain tended to be in the hands of ineffective or corrupt officials who were trying to benefit themselves more than the population. So the CPA, or the Coalition Provisional Authority, were trying to stage manage that at the same time as trying to get some elections going so that they can start withdrawing forces and bringing Iraqi forces in to replace us.
And it's a six-month tour, is it, Matt? You're down for six
months?
Right. Right. So do you have downtime? Or do you get R&R in Basra? I suppose that's an oxymoron. Is it basically you do 6 months, you do it 24/7, and then you get back on the Hercules and you get back to the UK?
Okay, well, speaking from my experience, we had one day off. We went to Kuwait for the day off, and then we had an operational stand down 10 days.
Right.
So in the 6 months, we had a single day and then a block of 10. So that's 2 days travel either side, basically. So a block of eight and one day off. So we had a little bit of time off, but otherwise the rest of the time it's just day on, day on, day on, day on. There's no such thing as a day off.
And what was the compound like? I mean, is it air conditioned, showers, you know, Sky TV? I mean, what are we talking?
Okay, well, so Basra Palace was not particularly comfortable. All we had was the old Republican Guard barracks. Inside it was quite a nice building. It had marbled floors, but we had to retrofit our own air conditioning in, which didn't always work. And the showers, there were no showers. We had to have those in the back of lorries. And because it's the desert, the water tended to heat up to like so hot that you could only wash one limb at a time. If you stood under their whole body, the water was just scalding hot. So it was a big problem. And ablutions, bathrooms, it was all basically like you'd see at a festival or a campsite, just porta toilets and such. So it's basic at best.
Do you get a big picture idea when you're on the ground as, you know, poor bloody infantry? I mean, did you get an idea of, okay, we're doing this because there's a clear aim, because obviously you read in other conflicts where people just go out and do it and they just, you know, they get the 1,000-yard stare. And I'm not saying, you know, you're in Vietnam, but you know where I'm coming from, this map.
Yeah, I know where you're coming from. We did have a general understanding. We knew that in Basra they were trying to get the elections to go ahead, and that was why we came under attack, because this terrorist group, they were called the Mahdi Army, under a guy called Muqtada al-Sadr, who, funnily enough, is a big cheese in Iraq now. But he was trying to get his electoral candidates in, and the easiest way to get that is to eliminate all the others. So by having the army on patrol, we're actually trying to secure the area and create an environment where it's hard for his people to operate and safe for people to vote for the candidate they wanted, as opposed to the candidate they're forced to vote for.
So at the end of, I mean, what's that last week like if you've done 6 months? Because they all say you should never count the days off, etc. I mean, or that last 48 hours, you must have been on tenterhooks to get back.
I remember the last week. Yeah, that it dragged on. The last week really dragged on. We were back out on patrol in a semi-rural area. I remember that. So we were checking inside the hand-dug canals and drainage ditches for explosives. Because, of course, we're going out. We're not just going to leave the place. We need to make sure it's safe to the people that we're handing over to. Funnily enough, it was the Royal Marines. They decided that the area was too hot to have a company of reservists in anymore. So we've got to get these guys out. And we're putting the Marines in instead because they're professional hard men as opposed to part-time hard men like we were.
What did you? I mean, did you get sort of grudging respect then from the regulars because you'd been out there, you'd proved yourself. You'd come undefined. You hadn't all sort of rushed back going, you know, I want my mum.
No, the people we did speak to, yeah, they had a grudge and respect, I suppose. But we had a grudge and respect for, well, not a grudge and respect, we all respect each other. When you're out there doing the job, I think that the banter is exactly that banter. It's that squaddy humour. It's that friendly professional rivalry you have, no matter what part of the military you're in. You understand that someone's got a role and that we've got a role. So I would say it wasn't just a grudge and respect. I think it was just a respect for anyone who was in that war zone and operating the way they are supposed to.
And here's the thing, because we're talking about people are rearming, talking about, and it's very easy for politicians to say, well, we're getting going on a war footing or whatever, but you have to get, here we go, boots on the ground. And the way that we're going to get people, if they're ready for any potential future conflict anywhere in the world, is by calling on reserve units, because it's very difficult to keep. I mean, people that, the army do have, the armed forces do have a recruitment problem. So this period, it's 20 years ago now, does mark where the military have gone since then, because we're going to have more and more reserve units if we are to maintain our borders, etc.
Well, that's right. I mean, you say it was 20 years ago. It was a long time ago. It's probably quite a similar situation now. But in Iraq, 20% of the force at any one time was reservist. So 80% was full-time. So 20, that's a huge proportion of the force, especially when you're thinking that formed units of military infantry are coming in, as opposed to what it was before in the lead up to the Gulf War. It was the first Gulf War, where it was just an individual reservist here and there backfilling, or maybe being a casualty replacement. It was actually complete formed units being put in. Like I said, it hadn't happened since the late 50s. And with the manpower shortage, no boots on the ground, they had to think of what to do. And so the reservists were called in.
So, I mean, why the book? Is it because, I mean, Nuclear Copper was brilliant because I hadn't thought about the specialist units for that. Is this to actually say this is the story of Basra from a reservist point of view?
It is, because I love reading. I love writing too, but I love reading. And I've read one book about a reservist, and I found them very, very hard to find. Now, I like the story and I like reading between the lines. And so what I've tried to do with this book is, first of all, I tried to make it very, very human, very accessible, even for people who don't know about the military. I tried to make it funny as well, because every time I read a military book, it's I'm the hero, I'm the best. Well, okay, 99% of the military aren't the hero, the best. They're just doing their job and they're quiet about it. So what I've tried to do is try to encapsulate that normal military standpoint and then spice it up with the infantry moments.
What are you hoping that people are going to take from the book, Matt?
What I hope people take from the book is they get a better understanding, not of the war, because the war itself is controversial. I get messages, people look me up on the internet and say, I don't like the war, blah, blah. But it's not about that. The soldier had about as much input about going to war as the general population did. They're just going because they're told to go. So what I'm trying to do is actually just show that a soldier is a bloke, just a normal guy or girl, just a normal person. Doing their jobs to the best of their ability, and they are, part of everyday life. And I wanted to show what that section of everyday life was, because as everyone else was going about their business in the UK or in Spain or in Japan, where I live now, there are people, reservists and military personnel, who are normal people like you and me, and they are going to be having some stories to tell in the future, and it's important to listen to them.
The book is called Basra and Back, the memoir of an infantryman in the Iraq War. Listeners, if you go to the Talk Radio Europe website and the virtual bookstore, you'll see a picture of a grinning Matt. That is you click on that and a well-known delivery service will be winging its way to you. Matt, if people want to follow you online, on the socials or on the Instagram or on the website, where can they find you?
Yeah, they can find me on the social. Type in Matt, which is two T's, and Okuhara, O-K-U-H-A-R-I. Just type in Matt Okuhara. Very easy to find. I'm the only person in the world with that name, apparently.
Indeed. The book is called Bazaar and Back. Matt, it's been great to speak to you again. Have a great day.
Thank you.